Hi there, and welcome to Open Mic here on Morehead State Public Radio. I'm your host, Leanne Akers, and today we're visiting with Dr. John Modaff, retired MSU professor of speech and the author of a new memoir, Teaching. Dr. Modaff, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Leanne. How are you?
I am doing well, enjoying diving into your new memoir. It chronicles 40 years in higher education and your experience across the U.S. at different universities and institutions. I guess to start, tell our listeners a little bit about why you decided to write this book.
Actually, I didn't decide to write a book. I knew my retirement was coming in May of 2020, and so in summer of 2019, I started keeping a journal. Reflecting on what I knew was going to be my last year. And through that year of teaching and then into the summer of 2020, I continued the journal. I shared it with a colleague from the University of Texas who was my teacher when I went there, and she had such a strong, favorable response to it that I shared it with other people, and people seemed to enjoy it so much. Several of them said, "You really ought to make this a book, because we think that family and friends aren't the only people who might enjoy it." So I published it as a book.
I feel like there's definitely a lot in the content for those of us who know you personally or who had you as a professor. I remember being a student of yours, and when I first started taking your classes, being very confused. Because you do have a different approach to the traditional approach to teaching, the quote-unquote traditional approach. Myself and all of your students here at Morehead State know that you start your classes, for example, with a song. And the book explores this, but let's talk a little bit about why you play guitar and sing a song at the beginning of every class.
Well, you're right. It's a break from tradition. I suppose the traditional opening of classes is something like this. And I spent a lot of time eavesdropping outside of classrooms for 40 years, so I can vouch for this. Most teachers come in, "Okay, let's get started," or, "Okay, who's here?" You know, and they'll call the roll and immediately start killing brain cells. And although it wasn't a plan, you know, I didn't sit at home and say, maybe I could use music to liven up the intro. It was just a happenstance that at the start of a class that I was teaching in Carbondale, Illinois at SIU there, that I had my guitar, and a student said, "Why don't you play one before class?" And I did, and I noticed a remarkable shift in the tone of the class. It wasn't remarkable in that it was huge or dramatic. It was just a different feel. And I just continued after that all through my work at Alfred and here at Morehead.
I always felt that that was kind of a vulnerable moment and therefore made it okay for those of us in the class to also therefore be vulnerable. And it kind of opened everything up to, hey, it's okay. Whatever's coming out, this is kind of a more organic experience, if you will.
Yes, as I developed a rationale for the behavior long after the behavior started, and I got to thinking, why does this work, or what value does it really have, and should I continue doing it? And you nailed it, Leanne. It's exactly it. If I do something strange and unusual and peculiar and potentially embarrassing, then it's okay for everybody to do that. And let's face it, speech class is all about being vulnerable and potentially embarrassed.
Mm-hmm. Now, I didn't have you for speech class, but I did have you for the master's program here at Morehead State in communications. And you discuss a lot in your book about the different types of students that you have. One of the things that impacted you the most, you know, from what I've seen of the book thus far, was teaching in the PRISM system. And a couple of times that you discuss that in the book. So I wanted you to talk a little bit about the impact that opportunity had on you.
Well, I must tell you, I was really afraid the first time I went in there, but I was a young professor. And of course, when you're untenured, you say yes to everything. So I accepted an invitation to finish a class for a professor who had become ill and just had a couple of weeks to teach at the end of a spring semester. And I, first of all, got over my fear pretty quickly, although I always remained afraid of the guards because they seemed to hate my guts and the academic mission at its essence, which I completely understand because a lot of them couldn't afford to go to college while the inmates were getting college for free. But once I got over my concern about the people who were going to be my students, I really enjoyed teaching there. So I think I put in another two semesters over in West Liberty at ECC.
And those particular inmates, there were some times when they understood things even more poignant than some of the students that you had at the university at the time.
It's true, but I suppose it wouldn't be fair to compare them to students on the outside, because the students on the outside face a lot of challenges that people in prison don't face. I know that sounds weird, but when you're in prison and you're going to college, from what the gentleman told me when I talked to them about why they did it and how they did it, it was a privilege and an honor, in a sense, that was very easy to lose and very hard to gain. And so they were highly motivated for lots of reasons. They could put in what they called good time by succeeding in the academic program. They might have a sentence reduction. It got them out of the population. It got them out of the workshop. And it qualified them for greater chances at employment when they got out of prison. And the statistics were very clear that recidivism for people who went to college or trade school or tech school in prison didn't go back to prison at anywhere near the rates that people who just bided their time in other ways. So these students were highly motivated. Many of them were taking numerous classes simultaneously. They read voraciously. They took their assignments very seriously. And of course, they were extremely disciplined and polite with me and with one another. Not necessarily because of me, but because of the discipline of the system. So it was really very different from the more laissez-faire approach outside of the institution.
I know that seeing college students on a day-to-day basis and seeing them now from a different perspective as a mentor or a coach, I don't consider myself a professor at all, but I do spend a lot of time with students. And although they have a very different experience than those who are incarcerated, there are, like you said before, they are facing their own challenges. And it is a very different approach, but how do you motivate those students when the stakes aren't as high?
Well, there's an interesting thing about college that I would say to students anytime any one of them said the reason they were doing something was because it was required. I said, there's no such thing as a requirement in college. And I usually got looks of pity and sympathy, like, oh, the poor old man, he's lost his mind. But college is optional. The state doesn't tell you you have to go to college. Everyone who goes to college by choice. And so that I found to be generally a pretty motivating theme when you reminded people that they were there because they chose to be there and that they could just as well choose not to be, then the burden fell back on them to enervate and to motivate themselves because it was their business. It wasn't something somebody else was having them to do. So that was one way I motivated them. The other one was to try to remember and to make them aware that I did remember how it was like to be a student or what it was like to be a student. The thousand things every day that mitigate against coming to class or getting assignments done. Life, family, work, health, roommates, relationships, traffic, bad food, all of it piles up. And I never forgot that. Those memories are really vivid for me from when I was a student. And so I think that helped me understand and most of the time excuse or at least give a break to the students who needed it. And I think they found that comforting and somewhat motivating to have that sympathy.
I don't remember why it was I came to speak with you when I was considering going into the master's program at Morehead State, but I remember us talking and you asking me why I wanted to get my master's degree. And when I explained my reasoning, you said, "Sounds like you're burning the barn to roast the pig." And I was like, I can't believe he said that. And it was so interesting to me, but that stuck with me. Why was I doing this? Why did I get the, why was I working towards this degree? And then after I graduated, it took me forever to find a job. And that was because we were in a major recession at the time. But at the time, when I finished, I was like, I'm supposed to be so excited about finishing this degree. And I'm being, people kept saying that you're overeducated and underexperienced to get a job. It took 9 months to find a job. But you were always so candid about those decisions. And really outside the classroom, that's something that many people don't think about, the impact that you have on individual students, not just the class of students, but really the individual opportunity to impact a student with just being in your office to chat. Is there anything that really stood out during your career, or was that something that you enjoyed, or was that something that made you nervous? Tell me a little bit about that experience.
I talk about office hours and being there in the book, and tell some stories about things that happened in the office and why I always kept my door open. And yes, I think that's every bit as important as anything a teacher does in the classroom or in the hallway. When you run into a student in the office and they want to talk about where they are and where they're going and where they hope to get, that's not necessarily something that me studying at the doctoral level in speech communication prepared me for. But I was that student sitting in offices for my 10-year career as a college student from 77 to 87. I did take a break and teach a little bit in there, but it mattered to me what those professors said. And I really do think that a professor who's willing to do that is doing a job that's just as important as being in the classroom. And in the classroom, we really have to be very cautious, and even more so now with sensitivities being so high in the cancel culture. But in the office, those rules change. We're there to listen, not speak. We're there to be candid and blunt and honest and not misdirect and not market, not sell, but really try to see and reflect back what that student wants and what they need. And if we have any advice on how to get there, to share it. But mostly we're there to listen and to respond in ways that help them make their own decisions.
And on that note, we're going to take a quick break here on Open Mic. We'll be right back after this.
In the 1950s and 1960s, jazz musicians such as John Coltrane, Charles Mingus, and Max Roach made recordings that invoked the struggle for racial equality in America. It's We Shall Overcome, Civil Rights Jazz, this week on Nightlights.
A special for Black History Month, Sunday evening at 6 on Morehead State Public Radio.
Welcome back to Open Mic here on Morehead State Public Radio. I'm your host, Leanne Akers, and today we're visiting with Dr. John Modaff, a retired professor of speech, and we're talking a little bit about his new memoir, Teaching, that was just released. I have a copy in my hands and am enjoying it thus far. Dr. Modaff, you're in this memoir, you're reflecting on your last semester as a teacher, this plan to retire and from Morehead State. And while you're working on this reflection, the world changed. I wanted you to kind of talk to our listeners a little bit about why you still thought it was important, as, I mean, the world was burning down around us. No one had any idea how things were going to turn out. We weren't even thinking about a vaccine at this point. We were just thinking about this horrible thing that was happening to the world as far as the coronavirus pandemic goes. But how did the events, why did you think it was still important to continue writing? And how did the events change the way you wrote your book?
It was a drastic impact. I almost stopped, but again, I wasn't writing a book at the time, so that made it easier to keep going. I was just writing for myself so that the inevitable lapses in memory that old age brings wouldn't lead to a loss of the details. And I felt certain details, names, places, room numbers, buildings were already slipping away. So it was important to keep writing regardless. In fact, in March, when it became clear that the world had changed and that the classroom was going to close down, I thought it was even more important for me to keep going for myself because of this weight that the pandemic and all of the consequences resulting from it was placing on me and other people. I talked to artists and writers, and all of them were having blocks. They were feeling this pandemic-driven lethargy. They just wanted to watch TV and take naps. And so to fight against that, I continued with the journal. Also, being essentially run out of the classroom on March 11th, that was my last day of teaching, was a shock because I hadn't necessarily planned a more graceful exit, but I had looked forward to a more graceful exit where I got to share some memories and experiences with students and colleagues. So the journal then became that sort of exercise for me, even though it was from me to me at that time. It took the place of the conversations and the camaraderie that I had expected and that I had felt for almost 30 years at Moorhead.
I remember when I learned that you were retiring, and I was, of course, saddened because I enjoyed your classes so much, and I was upset that we wouldn't get that opportunity to like have the reception, the retirement reception, like we do for so many here at Moorhead State. And of course, that's still not happening. The people who are retiring at this point are just quietly exiting, and that's hard for your peers as well as for the individual going through the exercise, I think. But I kind of have this sneaking suspicion that you're one of the ones who would have said, I don't want a reception.
Right. I was not sad, except for one thing. The food's usually terrible. And people are standing around wondering, when will this be over so I can get back to grading papers? But I do regret not being able to give the speech that is allowed at the reception. You know, the candidate gets to say a couple of lines to the assembled people. And it would have been nice to poke some fun and to do some reflecting. So I did miss that. But you're right, I'm not Mr. Society. I'm not super sociable. So I didn't miss the reception per se. The other thing about being abruptly ended like that, that came to mind numerous times, was that so what? What I missed out on, these little, you know, amenities and so forth, were nothing compared to what other people were going through. People were sick, people were dying, people were losing their jobs, losing their fortunes, losing their businesses, ending relationships. And so my little, abbreviation of my teaching career there in the last 2 months was nothing compared to that. And so I spend about two lines feeling sorry for myself in this 200-page book. And the rest of it is just, oh, well, you know, get over it.
There are some exercises that you did in your classes that at the time just baffled me. I did not understand why we were doing this. And I know some of your other students have said, I don't know, I don't get it. I don't know why we're doing this. But then in retrospect, I was like, oh, that's why we're doing this. And now I've implemented a lot of the things that you did in my day-to-day interactions with students. And you talk a little bit about that similar experience in the book, how the teachers have impacted you throughout the years. And you start very early. I mean, kindergarten is where we start that as far as talking about each individual teacher. And I wonder, did they all impact you? I mean, some of them are, your explanation is pretty brief, but I mean, the point is they all did.
Yes, they did. For the record, listeners, Leanne Akers is a teacher. She is a news director, but she spends a lot of time with students, so she knows of what she speaks. My teachers, I started in first grade. I didn't have preschool or kindergarten back in those days for me, but my teachers, even the bad ones, were exemplary in teaching me, in some cases, what not to do. So I write in the book a couple of times that even the lousy teachers were helpful guides about my own teaching style. And it wasn't necessarily all the exemplary teachers that inspired me. Sometimes I was inspired to do the opposite of what the crappy teachers did. Also, I realized in reflecting throughout the book that even though a teacher might be considered bad in their style or their attitude, like the teacher Paul Hurley, who called me the wrong name every single day when we called roll, they can still be great teachers. And so I didn't have to like Paul Hurley, who was just this acid-tongued old crab, but his class was great. And he talked about early American poetry with absolute expertise and depth and insight that opened up the poems to me and to the other students in ways that we could not have done on our own. So even though I'd put him in my bad teacher category, I put him in my good educator category because I learned a lot in his class. So that was a valuable lesson to me. You don't have to be the perfect person all the time. And students don't even have to like you in order for them to get what they pay for as far as education.
Now, I was lucky enough to get a copy of your book signed from you, and I appreciate that so, so greatly. But where can our listeners grab a copy? I know that there will be people who want to check this out.
Yes, if you just type John Modaff into Amazon, the book will pop up, and it's available in Kindle and in paperback. But a couple of my potential readers, people I know who don't want to give any more money to Amazon, have asked me if I would secure a copy and send it to them. So if someone doesn't want to send the head of Amazon any more money, just email me. And it's ITSJVM1958@gmail.com. That's ITSJVM1958@gmail.com. And I'll make sure you get a copy, taking Amazon out of the mix. But it can be ordered through Amazon. You'll have it in a few days. And I would really appreciate it, no matter how you react to it, if you would leave some remarks, if you have any.
Well, I have enjoyed it so far, and I look forward to having the time this weekend. I actually went and did some homework early this week for my continued studies, and so I could have some time this weekend to finish it up. Dr. John Modaff, I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with us today. That's all the time we have here on Open Mic, so thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, Leanne. Take care.
Thanks for tuning in to Open Mic. Our show is produced by Greg Jenkins, and our theme music is Turtle in the Creek, composed by Galen Green and performed by The Wooks. Produced by Morehead State Public Radio with the generous support of listeners just like you. We'll see you next Friday.